agreement, like you mentioned before, Dick, was very much involved. And they determined from a Mariner 9 flight, which was an orbiter mission, looking at the dust storms, Carl Sagan got involved with that and analyzed the dust somehow. Figured out that this dust was a clay-like material. And the clay, this is all over the planet, and it's clay-like material. One analyzed with the equipment that they sent with the Viking, had a tendency to give the same results, similar to like photosynthesis or, some kind of organic material when it was cooked and heated and, whatever they do, some kind of chemical reaction that was duplicating those results. So that's why the end game of the whole, and results were non-conclusive, by the time they finished analyzing everything. Those Vikings, by the way, had radioisotope thermoelectric generators on them. And they would, they functioned for years. One went almost 3 years, the other one went around 6 years. John said with the scoop and all, he's right about that. I remember reading that. So they would pick it up and work like a little train. It would, it's like a trolley type of thing, would come back and go into one of three of the different analyzing machines to analyze the soil. And before Vikings went, there was this one guy, scientist, and he wanted something called the wolf trap to go up, some kind of a thing to where he would think that the microbes are going to like this food and it would give off some kind of results. But his experiment never went. But after that, he was turned down. He took his experiments to Antarctica, where they thought they weren't going to find anything. And he was working there. He went down to McMundo, and then they shipped him out to some other place for all his tests. He's out there by himself, which I think was kind of ridiculous, wherever he was, and he'd throw off a cliff or something and die. Well, eventually they went out and got his test that he was going to be leaving there. He wanted to leave it there for a month and then come back. And wife made, the widow made sure that they got all the results back and analyzed everything, and they found microbes galore, So his test really proved conclusively that system would work. Because they thought this Antarctica was dry as a bone, and he found all kinds of stuff in every one of his tests that he left out there. That's all I know about Viking. That's pretty much it for the space report. I'll stand by for questions and what have you. Back to you, Dick. KQLRW, WS2N.
I'm going to be passing it over to questions for anybody on the space report in a minute. First, each of the Vikings had an orbiter and a lander. And the orbiter was used, as I see from what you're describing, recalling my memory, to take a last-minute view of the landing site and say, yeah, that's a good site. And after the lander was released and did land, and both of them landed successfully, did the orbiter do any radio relay, or did the lander always talk directly back to Earth? So did the orbiter on Viking 1 or the orbiter on Viking 2, did they ever do any RF relaying, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
I know they did both. They did, yeah. From my understanding, they did both. I'll have to double check. Wonder if they used UHF like they used with Curiosity and what they used with Spirit. Spirit's not working anymore. What they still use for Opportunity. That works on UHF. So they probably did. I'll have to check. That would be interesting to find out what frequency they. But yeah, they had direct contact with constant contact, like I said, with one of them for 6 years, you know, pointed its antenna at Earth. Back to you, Jack.
Yeah, the way, I'll pick up comment in a second. The way the current landers on Mars work is that because the distance is a short distance between the lander and the orbiter, you can transmit a pretty high UHF data rate, because the orbiter has a much bigger, higher gain antenna aimed at Earth, it can relay the information back to Earth at a higher data rate. That's the way the current landers are working. Did Viking do any of that to your knowledge, Paul? Did the higher gain antenna on the orbiter speed up the communication between lander, orbiter, and back to Earth? WS2N, K2LIW?
Probably not. You know, I remember looking at the pictures and when they were coming back, and it was like full-screen TV, you know. You watch one line come at a time. Where nowadays, you know, the pictures, they come down one right after the other. I mean, it's not video, but boy, they come down fast when they first land. And they're showing you the results on TV. But no, this is like smoking on TV. It was painfully slow, so I'm sure it was direct. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, who is the person who wanted to make a comment or a question? Sounds like it was probably Joe. Over to you, sir. K2LAW.
K2RIW, KC, SHO. When they went to use the scoop on the lander, they weren't able to control it, and they kind of panicked a bit, and it turns out that they forgot to upload the software to control the scoop. So they definitely had bidirectional communication, so then they uploaded the software and got it running again. K2RIW, KC2, SHO.
Yeah, your audio system is working a little bit differently now, John. You're getting a little bit of dropout. I'm not quite sure is it overmodulation or what. But maybe Paul's got some comments on that. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I don't remember having problems with the scoop. You know, they had a lot of problems. Color of the sky and all. Well, actually, the first pictures were all black and white. But, you know, calibration was off on a lot of things, including all the detectors, the life source microbiology detectors. And, but, you know, I liked that one article that came out about Carl Sagan. He was really involved with that. And he pretty much nailed it. But again, it's non-conclusive, but he did say that this dust that goes around the planet, it carries this clay-like material. Somehow he analyzed this clay-like material. I don't know how he figured out what that was. Maybe from the test on Viking. I don't know. But it was all a lot of years before we did anything after that. We had to go all the way to, 1996, you know. Probably 30 years later. I mean, 20 years later. It was with that small rover, Sojourner. So, and then they knew that would work, this whole wheel system that they had. And then we went with, in 2004, Spirit and Opportunity. But as far as actual detecting, somebody asked about that. They don't have this microbe detecting type of equipment. You know, they really don't. And then nobody's done it since. This last flight that was supposed to go up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And that was supposed to go up in 2018. That has something like that. That'll be the next one. And probably the 2020 United States rover that we sent, which is going to be very similar to Curiosity, will probably have it. Back to you.
again now, Paul. Is the European Space Agency sending something in 2018, and we're going to be sending the update of Curiosity in 2020, and I think you're saying that might have a microbial detector on board? Run those two by again now, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, okay. We got to backtrack. European Space Agency just launched using a Russian rocket, or these proton rockets, that heavy lift vehicle. They launched two spacecraft to Mars a few months ago. Now, that will eventually get to Mars probably 5 months from now, I think. Maybe October. Probably October or November. Okay, that one has an orbiter. It's called the Trace Orbiter. That's going to look for methane and stuff like that in the atmosphere. This has a lander. It's called Schiaparelli. Schiaparelli is a lander similar to Pathfinder. It's going to go down and just land, and it's going to run on batteries, and if they get, you know, a day or two out of it, they're going to be happy. It's a proof of concept that the European Space Agency can do this, can land something. Another mission was planned. Let me drop it. And it's a rover mission that's supposed to go in 2018. Unfortunately, they're way behind. I don't know if it's funding or technical reasons, whatever. They decided to go with 2020. But that was supposed to be launched by another proton rocket by the Russians for the European Space Agency. That rover, I read years ago when they were developing this, that it has a microbial type of detector on board. I believe that the 2020 one that we're also going to send, similar to Curiosity, I haven't heard anything conclusive, but my guess is that'll have some kind of microbial detector on board. I just can't believe that they won't do that on that one. But, everything's not finalized on that. But that's going to go 2020. You watch. That should be a good mission. You know, it's a Curiosity mission on steroids. Back to this.
I wonder if the USA 2020 update of the Curiosity, I presume it's going to be a slightly larger, or at least as large, with other testing facilities on board. I wonder if that's going to be run by a radioactive thermal generator. I'm having trouble believing they can put big enough solar cells on them to produce all the power that they need. But if it is a radioactive thermal generator they're planning, I know that they're running very low on plutonium to run those things. I think that's the whole reason why Juno has got a huge solar array, because they're really getting pretty short on polonium. Correct me on some of these things, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Okay, yeah, the European Space Agency, their rover is solar panel. It's, similar to Opportunity and Spirit, they were solar panel. 2020 definitely is going to be with an RTG, so that will be just like Curiosity with the radioisotope thermoelectric generator, and that will also come in with the same kind of landing process. It's really going to be the same weight. It's going to come in exactly the same way. It's going to come down on the with the heat shield. Heat shield will eventually separate. It'll be hanging from a crane, sky crane. As it comes down, it'll have eight retro rockets firing to slow this whole setup down. And then when it gets near the surface, it'll start lowering the rover down to the planet, have some pyrotechnics go off, cut all the cables, and it'll be, they'll have wheels on the ground again. So it's the same setup. Risky business. I think they lucked out last time, and I think they're pushing their luck now. We'll see. Juno, three big solar panels set at 120 degrees apart from one another, and roughly 120 feet. too. They got better at solar panels, you know, making these, expanding these solar panels. Yeah, these things would probably put out 4,000 watts, 5,000 watts, whatever it is, going around Earth. Actually, probably more than that, because in Jupiter orbit, because of the inverse square law, now you're down to 400 watts, because 400 watts is all they need. The main reason why it doesn't pay to put an RTG on that is this is not going to be a long mission. They're going to do 30, well, it was originally 33, now 37 orbits of Jupiter. Now they're long orbits. Each one, you know, you're looking at probably a 13-month, 14-month mission. And that's it. The reason for that is it's going in very, very low to Jupiter's atmosphere. Not that the atmosphere is going to affect it, but Jupiter has extremely high radiation contact. I mean, big-time electrons flying through the air. And without the protection that Juno has on it, it would probably be destroyed in the first orbit, first pass. But it's got all the electronics mounted in a box, and it's a good-sized box, like it's a big spacecraft. But the electronics are mounted in a titanium, one-inch thick titanium thick, you know, alloy box. And like if you were inside the box, you would be getting 800 times less radiation inside the box than you would be on the outside of the box. So it's very well protected. And also the path that they're making with their orbit, the way they're coming in and coming out, it's the least influenced by this magnetic field, which is, you know, creating this high radioactive area. So that's the story on Juno. We're going to hear a lot. I'm sure this will be on the news July 4th. They got to put this on regular news, you know, Channel 12. I'm sure 13 might even have a special on it. They're usually pretty good. It can't be PBS. Back to you, Dick.
On July 4th, when they do that retro burn to put Juno in a polar orbit around Jupiter, I'm guessing in the beginning there's going to be a highly elliptical orbit. To your knowledge, is going to be, are there going to be future burns to make the orbit a little bit more circular? Or are they going to use any Jupiter atmospheric drag in order to circularize the orbit? Have there been any discussions along those lines, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
No, it's not like some of the Mars missions that they had with the aero braking. This is strictly going to be a retro fire for, I think, 34 minutes or something. Just slow themselves down, and that'll put them in a highly elliptical orbit, is really what they want. And it's going to be polar orbit, which should be pretty cool. They really don't have any good close-up views of Jupiter. The polar orbit, you know, north and south side. They got plenty of equatorial ones from high up, because for many years Galileo was orbiting that planet. And although Galileo, the goal was to study the planet, people found themselves more intrigued in investigating the moons of Jupiter. Where this one is not going to pay much attention to the moons, this one is really looking at Jupiter itself. So there is a difference between Galileo and Juno. Back to you, Dick.
Question, Dick. Go right ahead with the question.
TC2WGB. Dick or Paul, either one. I was reading an article a couple of weeks ago, and it was about Jupiter, and the claim was that the G-force on Jupiter is 10,000 times Earth. So we're 1G, that's 10,000 Gs. Does that sound correct to you? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
before, but it's way, way down. I know it's got a short day. You know, it's only 10 hours long. But as far as the gravitational pull, I mean, where would you be standing? that's hard to say. I know it's 318. You could get 318 Earths inside of Jupiter, so I guess you could do the math there. That's what it would be. 318 of us would fit inside of Jupiter. Back to you,
sir. That's a biggie. I'm kind of amazed that they're not interested in any of the moons. And I guess they're going to try to do some radar testing of the atmosphere. I know that either Jupiter or Saturn, one or the other, has the biggest aurora at the North Pole and the South Pole. So since this is a polar orbit, they're going to see those poles a lot better than they ever have before. Review for us, Paul, if you happen to remember, what are the major measurements of Jupiter that they want to make with Juno? And did you say that the something like 110 or 120 foot tip-to-tip solar panel? Boy, that's big. And I think you said that would make 4 kilowatts at the Earth, but they're only going to get 400 watts when they're out there at Jupiter. And I think Jupiter is what? Something like 3 or 4 astronomical units away from the Sun? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, I believe Jupiter's 5. That's why I say 25, you know, probably four times the distance from Earth. You know, it's probably 25 times the, if you've got wattage, I know 400 watts is going to be operating watts at Jupiter. So, whether it's 4 or 5, I don't know, but each one would be squared, so it's either 16 or 25, or whatever. I think you'd have a tremendous amount of power. Going around the Earth. But, you know, since they're able to do it and all they need is that 400 watts, that's going to be good enough. So, I don't know. I think you had another question in there, but I don't remember back to that.
Yeah, I'm guessing aurora is one of the things they want to look at. I'm not quite sure if it's Jupiter or Saturn that's believed to have the biggest aurora in the solar system. And do you happen to know what specific measurements that Juno is going to be making on Jupiter? And once you've got solar panels that are going to last for a long time, why should they only make 37 orbits? And I guess part of what's going on is the funding to use the ground station to gather the data. And maybe X number of years downrange, there won't be any new data to gather. But since Jupiter is such a big attractor of comets and asteroids and whatever that come into the solar system, I'll bet you X number of years downrange, Juno is going to be in the right place to observe something big either swishing by or hitting Jupiter. I'll bet you that mission's going to be extended, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I hope they do extend it because, I mean, they claim that it's really not going to survive past these 37 orbits. By the way, originally it was 33 orbits, and then they did change that. So they wanted to go into a little bit better orbit. The idea is to keep away from all this radiation. But they do predict that the electronics will be fried after a year or so. That's what's going to happen. There's one pass behind Jupiter when they first go into orbit. It's going to be an Earth day, so they're going to have to wait out like almost 24 hours to find out if everything worked out, you know, worked okay after they go into, I guess, trance. It would be trans-Jupiter injection, I guess. I'll try to make up a word for it. But they're gonna get into that for a half hour, and then eventually dip behind Jupiter from the North Pole to the South Pole. From the north to the south, it's gonna take one day, one Earth day, to get that far. From what I heard, they gotta wait a day to find out if this thing works. Wow. We don't have any other satellites behind there that could, you know, relay the information. That's what was cool about Mars. You know, we had Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and when Curiosity went through the atmosphere, and when the Phoenix one, that was another one that we sent that wasn't a rover, went to Mars. Both of them, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, not only used themselves as a repeater, but got pictures of the parachutes as it was entering the Mars atmosphere. I saw that. That was really...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Yeah, I heard you say earlier, and I thought I'm hearing it for the first time, that most of the sensitive electronics, particularly the memory chips, I'm going to guess, are being contained in a titanium box, did you say, that's 1 inch thick to try to do shielding. I'm guessing that there's a huge magnetic field of Jupiter, therefore it has a huge Van Allen belt, is my word for it. In other words, it's got a very large amount of radiation. It attracts a whole lot of solar wind particles and other things that are in a cyclic orbit north to south, like the Van Allen belt. So that radiation is so heavy that the delicate electronics has to be in a 1 inch thick titanium box. Did I hear you say that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's a titanium gold alloy type of box, 1 inch thick. The box itself weighs 400 pounds, like a small piano, you know. So it's a big spacecraft. And that's going to protect the electronics from all these deep dives into the atmosphere, and really almost into the atmosphere. I believe it's 3,000 miles above the top of the atmosphere. And with the detectors on board, I think they probably have like 9 different detectors, whatever it is, different instruments. They'll be able to find out exactly what the atmosphere is made out of. And all of that. But as far as their magnetic field, just what you were saying before, I'm just thinking of it now, what you said about Mars, no magnetic field, you don't want to go there, you don't even have a Van Allen belt because you don't have this spinning planet with a molten core. Here you got Jupiter, 318 Earths, spinning. We spin once around in one day. This thing's spinning around in 9 hours. So this must really, really be kicking up this magnetic field, which creates the Van Allen belt for Jupiter. Very destructive, from what I hear. Back to you.
And I'm pretty sure what you said, and I'm repeating it now, is that originally 33 orbits, they extended to 37, and they're not right now thinking of going beyond that because each one of those deep dives on the perigee, paracynthian, I guess it is, or perijupitian, the lowest portion of the orbit is going to be digging so deep into the radiation belt around Jupiter that they're concerned that the electronics might not survive very much beyond the 37 orbits. I'll bet you there's a good chance with that 1 inch thick titanium gold box doing such a good job of shielding, they may find that memory has so few errors after 37 days that they've got the ability to go beyond. and to go beyond, just a matter of time before some great big Shoemaker Levy 9 like comet or asteroid comes whizzing by or hitting Jupiter, and there'll be interesting photographs for Juno to take. There's some pretty good cameras on Juno. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, oh sure. I mean, this thing was launched in 2011, so whatever our technology was in 2011, pretty good cameras. A lot better than what they had on Galileo and all the other missions to all the outer planets. You know, even Cassini going around Saturn, that was designed in the early 1990s. But that comes back with beautiful pictures. This should be pretty interesting. And I'm with you. I think I know if this thing survives after a year or so, whatever the planned mission was, they have 37 orbits. They've got to create an extended mission. But, what I read is they really weren't interested there. So I don't know. And then what are they going to do with it after? Deorbit it and let it crash into Jupiter like they did with Galileo? What a shame. But that's what they did. And that's what they're going to do with Cassini, too. They're going to, this September. This September rumor, are we in 2017. Next September, they're going to take Cassini and crash it into the planet. The idea is not to contaminate any of the moons. These missions were not, they didn't go through the sophisticated sterilization process that the landers do. So they can't take any chances of getting a boogie-woogie flu down on one of the planets. Back you just...
Boogie-woogie. Those are World War II words of a certain style of music. But I guess boogie-woogie means bugs. You don't want to put any microbes and bugs and worms onto those planets, onto those moons, because they possibly have life. Anybody have any further questions for Paul on the space report? On any of the above, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. I'm guessing that the solar panels, due to ultraviolet radiation, slowly lose power. But when you're out that far at 5 astronomical units, I'll bet you the rate at which the solar panels lose power is slower than the rate at which a radioactive thermal electric generator loses power. As such, those solar panels may start off at 400 watts, and after 37 orbits, you may have 390 watts still being generated. So therefore, with a titanium gold box and those solar panels, I'm going to make a guess, Paul, they're going to go way beyond 37 orbits. They're probably not worried about this one hitting a moon. Although maybe they are. What kind of sterilization took place? Is this one again got to be crashed? You did say that. So it didn't have enough sterilization. So can they intentionally crash it after some number of orbits? Just to make double darn sure it doesn't hit a moon. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, yeah, it does. This one, Cassini, most of them, there was no reason to go through the contamination process. They had no plans of landing them. They only do that with the landers. By the way, Elon Musk is going to have to do that. He's naturally going to comply with NASA's system to sterilize his Dragon crewed vehicle, or as he calls the Red Dragon, is the official name. When that thing lands on Mars, got is some kind of plasma detector. So with that plasma detector, I still haven't figured out what that's going to detect. But they wanted to make sure that was working in 2013 when it did a flyby of Earth. The reason it did a flyby of Earth in 2013 was to pick up speed. I think it gained like 8,000 miles per hour or something. But it was launched in 2011. And when it came flying by here in that October of 2013, that's when they wanted hams to transmit on 10 meters. You know, a slow code. And that's what we did. And it took a long time to do that. You had to hold the key down for like 30 seconds and then release it. You know, just to make one word. And there were 1,400 people that participated. And if you did, they sent you a QSL card back. And I got one. That's Juno and the picture on it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Paul, you participated. Other than you telling them, how did they know you participated? I'm having trouble believing that they picked up your call letters. But was that success, was that mission of amateur radio operators sending very slow speed code, was that successful? Did the detection take place up all the head?
Yeah, the plasma detected it. And collectively, with all these thousands of signals, and it didn't matter what side of the earth you were on, they didn't care. They know that the plasma detector detected the signal coming from Earth, and they had a time. You're looking at your computer, and you had to watch the computer, and when it went to a certain color, you know, you had to push down and hold it, and then release. You know, everybody was doing it at the same time. So if you participated, you know, you put the information in and transmitted it, the data that, you know, that you did it. And then eventually, I don't know, it took like 6 months, maybe longer. We got a card back from Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California from NASA. Back to you, Dick.
You transmitted how many watts? Was it 10 meters that you made the transmission on, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, and that was the whole deal. You know, depending on your call letter, you got a different frequency. You know, they assigned you a different frequency. Up a little, down a little. I forget the exact numbers. But, you know, because mine was WS, I had a certain frequency I had to use. So I guess they wanted a wideband transmission going up there. Whatever, they found out that the detector was working, and they now know that when it gets to Jupiter, that thing is going to be working. That was fun. Back to you.
And what do they call that detector? I don't think it was gamma ray. It was a, what kind of detector, Paul?
I gotta look. It's some kind of a plasma detector. You know, they have these acronyms that go with it. I'll have to look. I'll find it. But, you know, it wasn't a radio. It wasn't an RF receiver. It was some kind of plasma detecting thing. So this plasma detection was somehow going to pick up this electromagnetic transmission. How that actually works, I don't know.
It doesn't sound like they gave us enough explanation on that one. The July issue of Scientific American, which arrived yesterday, very near the front of the magazine, has a pretty strong bid for us going back to the moon. I vaguely remember that Bush was in favor of going back to the moon. Obama thought that the moon, we've already done that, so let's go to Mars. Well, what Scientific America is saying, that even if we're going to go to Mars, there's a huge advantage of wringing out the hardware by going to the moon. And the moon allows you to mine a lot of useful materials. Let me drop this. They're now fairly sure that at least at the poles they've got water in the moon. You take that water and use electrolysis to boil it into, to break it down into oxygen and hydrogen. You can run your fuel cell on that, and you now can make liquid fuel for rockets. And to mine the moon for the raw materials, like rocket fuel, and then use that to blast off from the moon, which has 1/6 gravity, has a huge economic gain as opposed to bringing the fuel up from the Earth and fighting that much heavier gravity of the Earth to get the heavy materials out there for whatever mission. And the article in Scientific American also made a bid that the mining of the materials on the moon can become an industry where you have now commercial value of those materials back on Earth. So, as I said, Scientific American is saying that we really, there's a bunch of reasons why we should be going to the moon with hardware that you don't just use once like we did on Apollo. Essentially, none of the hardware was built to be used again on Apollo. Let me drop it. So, the article says moon has a lot to offer. But the article didn't get into the details that I'm worried about, is that is the huge high temperature at high noon and the huge cold temperature at nighttime. I think the temperature goes down to minus 200 and some odd degrees at night. You may know that in Antarctica there's a mission right now in process where two aircraft have gone as far as southern Chile, and they're waiting for favorable weather on Antarctica because there is a person who is strongly in need of medical attention back in the United States. So they're making this very dangerous maneuver of trying to bring an aircraft into the South Pole to pick up this injured person, this person that needs medical care, and they're going to have to be landing in minus 70 degree weather in the pitch blackness of night, because it's nighttime at the South Pole now for the next few months. Except for a full moon, there's very little light. You've got to land your aircraft on this ice patch. Don't turn off the motors. Somehow refuel with warm fuel. Minus 70 degrees is cold enough that you literally freeze the fuel that's in the tank. You can't stay there very long. You can't turn off the engines. There's a good chance you'll never start them again. They very rapidly put the patient on board, take off, and come back. But because they're so dependent on weather, let me drop them. The news reports are saying that when the aircraft is on Antarctica, over Antarctic continent, the nearest portion of it, they still have hundreds of miles to go, maybe even 1,000 miles to go. And so as they fly those last, let me call it 1,000 miles, they've got to worry about getting beyond the point of no return, where they're forced to go the rest of the way inland, no matter how bad the weather is, in order to refuel. So it's a rather dangerous mission. There was a mission like this once before, which was successful. I don't know if it was in the dead of South Pole winter like it is right now. And let's see, this coming Monday is the first day of summer, which is obviously, as far as the sun is concerned, let me drop it. It's the least amount of solar exposure, the most amount of coldness of of Antarctica this coming Monday. So it looks like essentially the worst possible time for this medical mission is taking place. So if you do get Scientific American, probably enjoy that article saying that we really got to go back to the moon. WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, I agree. I mean, and then it's going to take probably hundreds of flights to set up the infrastructure you need for all the stuff that they need to do. But once it's there, you know, that's good. It could be sustaining, except for the food problem. And who knows what they could do with that. Some kind of solar bombs that could work on a South Pole, maybe. I don't know. That's going to be a problem. You know, they do have this hydroponic growing system. So, once they solve a couple of these infrastructure problems, you can leave people there all the time like they have down in at Antarctica. I wonder if this sick person is down by the pole, South Pole, where they, I think they're up to around, they leave around 200 people now. Used to be 40. And they think they're up to 200 year-round at the actual pole. And then there's a couple of thousand during the year at McMundo. And then there's, at least five or six other stations from different countries all over Antarctica. So collectively, I think they probably have, during the warm months, probably 10,000 people. But very few down at the actual South Pole. I think the depth number's less than 200. Is that where this plane has to go in and get them, or are they in one of the higher latitudes, like McMundo?
Yeah, I think they pronounced that McMurdo. But yes, this medical patient is right at the South Pole, the hardest place to get to pole. So he's going to land on this great big snowy field with skis in the dark at minus 70 degrees. It makes that clear if it's minus 70 Fahrenheit or centigrade, but it doesn't matter very much. Minus 40 centigrade is equal to minus 40 Fahrenheit. In either case, it's extremely cold. Cold enough to freeze the fuel in the tanks. And how you keep the fuel in the tanks warm enough, I don't know. And since they're going to be going beyond the point of no return, when they get to the South Pole, they're going to have to be refueled. And how do they heat the fuel that they're going to put into the tanks? You can't just take a barrel of oil that's sitting out there at minus 70 degrees and pour it into the tank. I think it would be like butter, if not solid. So, this is a risky mission, and essentially the worst possible place on planet Earth. Where do you pull? K2RIW.
Dick, I have a quick announcement when you get a chance.
Fire away, John.
KC2WGV. All right, Dick. Dave, WA2SVM, just sent a thing over in the chat room that the W2XTV Repeater Club is going to have their field day in Livingston, New Jersey, and he wants everybody to know it's listed on the ARRL website, so just want to send that message in that was sent to us. They know that TechNet has a listening audience that's quite large, so I guess they want to take advantage of that, which is fine. Another thing, I would like to thank Dr. Roy. He did the research on that book I was talking to you about last week about microwave technology. It was written in 1950, and he found a website which I was able to purchase the book. I have the book in my possession now, and it is in excellent condition, which I didn't think it was when I was looking at the photograph of the book. So I just wanted you to know that Dr. Roy facilitated that purchase, and I was able to procure it for a very reasonable price. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I think it was last week on the TechNet that I was talking about this very good microwave book, in my mind, authored by Southworth. Is that the book that you found, Paul? I mean, John? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, that's it. And Dr. Roy found it on one of the websites, and he sent me the link, and I clicked on it, and it was the exact book. It worked out perfectly. And it, like I said, it's interesting reading also.
Yeah, you probably already discovered there are a number of sections in the book where it's got some very good illustrations. Every possible mode of waveguide is shown as an illustration. And to make those illustrations back in the days when they didn't have computer-generated graphics, that had to be done by draftsmen, I think. And it's a very nice diagram of various kinds of waveguide components. Hybrids, dummy loads. I think there's like 15 separate ways of making a dummy load, microwave dummy load, shown in there. Horns. So when it comes to waveguides, microwave circuits, that's a darn good book. I keep forgetting the name of the book. Southworth is the author, and I keep forgetting the name of the publisher. Addison Wesley, is it? So what's the full name of the book that you've now got, Paul? If it happens to be near you. I said Paul. I meant John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Application, a waveguide application, and something. I don't remember the title, or I don't remember the publisher either, but I will get that information. Very interesting book, very detailed, and some of the drawings showing you the circulating currents within the waveguide, or the circulating patterns in the waveguide, were extremely interesting, and I will discuss during the week. There are some graphs. I have no clue of what those graphs are supposed to be representing. Even though I read the paragraph, I don't really understand. So we'll touch base on that, but I think I'm going to have a lot of fun reading what I can understand in that book.
So I think what I'm going to have to do next week, Paul, at the next TechNet, I'll have to make sure I take that book off the shelf and have it in front of me. So you're going to tell me to go to page 37. And what in the world does that graph mean? Some of them I know. Not all of them. And I think it's a 1950 book, an oldie but goodie.
1950, I believe the page number is 107, but I'll double check.
So it's page 107 that contains the diagram that's right now troubling you?
Yes, it's a graph that looks like some distorted U-shape. Lines, and I was trying to figure out what that was supposed to represent, and I just couldn't do it. I maybe have to read it a couple of times, but I believe it was page 107.
And what's the chapter title? Chapter, page 107 is into what? Transmitters, receivers, waveguide components? Roughly, what is the subject matter of that chapter, John?
I don't remember that either, Dick. I just perused the book very quickly, just thumbing through it. There was some excellent, there's two pages of very glossy, high-polished, like magazine-type paper that have photographs of, I don't know what they were photographing, but I didn't even read that, but there's maybe 20 pictures on there. You know, when you look in your book, you can't miss those two pages, and they're in color. Very well done.
In color? My issue, I don't think, had color. But those shiny pages, I believe those are the pictures of all of the waveguide modes, rectangular and round waveguide modes. And there's a zillion of them. I think that could quite possibly be the picture. Color. I don't remember seeing a color page in mine. Huh. You're sure yours is the second edition, 1950? You may have a later edition then, John.
I didn't check the title, but it was listed as 1950, Southward, and the exact book. But I'll double check that. I'll become more familiar with the book and have some better information to be able to speak more intelligently about it. But
Great stuff.
I am curious what they charged you for that as a used book, and who did you buy it from? Was that Amazon?
It went through Amazon from another seller who deals in buying and selling used books. The book is in, I thought from what I saw that I was going to have to send it out to a rebinder because I do that occasionally, and they do it in a leather-bound hardcover, which is like the law books. They do an excellent job, and it was only $50, Dick, with shipping.
Yeah, that's a very good deal. The latest issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, for instance, is, I think, listing for $137. So that book for $50 is definitely worth it. And that'll keep you off the streets at night, John, studying those diagrams, trying to figure out what they all mean. By the time you finish half of that book, you'll have an awful lot of microwave knowledge as to how does that microwave signal feel as it goes down that waveguide and it decides which one of the modes it wants to favor. I'm only half kidding. You may know that one of the real microwave experts of Long Island was Harold Wheeler of the Wheeler Laboratory. Talk to any engineer that worked with Harold Wheeler, and they were in engineering heaven. But people used to make a joke, and I don't know if it was his quote or not, that he probably knew how that waveguide felt, how that wave, microwave signal felt when it went down that waveguide and went through that to that hybrid and around that E-plane and H-plane joint bend. And when it came out the horn, and when the signal finally gets out of the horn, it gets happy because it's about to go into free space. But the horn itself is not an impedance match of the free space. Lots of people think so. I think it is not. We've come up to the magic hour, the bewitching hour. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1607 and Space Report number 206. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week. And discussing both the red and the blue electrons. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, I would certainly like to thank Dr. Roy and everybody who attended tonight, as usual, and hope they can return next week. And maybe some more questions will come in the mailbag, and we can have some more fun. But yeah, be kind to each other and enjoy the hobby. You're supposed to be having fun here. And good night to you, Paul. So I'll turn it over to you, Paul. KC2WGB.
Okay, 73, John, Dick. And maybe one of these days we'll talk more about that South America, correction, the Antarctica story. I know they did.